The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Amateur Traveler, episode 553. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about fjords and glaciers, hikes, salmon, and bears as we go to the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Without any further ado, let's talk about Alaska. I'd like to welcome to the show Merith Griffith, who is a tour guide from the Seward area of Alaska and has come to talk to us about the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska. Merith, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
And I should say that Merith and I have met in person, although not in Alaska. We actually met on the recent Uncruise that I did in Baja, where Merith was one of our exploration leaders. And so you're probably right now, if you're in the enhanced version, looking at a picture of her in a kayak. So Merith, where is the Kenai Peninsula, first of all? Let's put it on a map for people.
If you're picturing Alaska in your head and you can see the southern coastline just along the Pacific, right in the middle of that, you'll have Anchorage. And if you go straight down from Anchorage, you will reach the Kenai Peninsula. It's this sort of funny-shaped peninsula right there in the North Pacific. A lot of coastline. It is about the size of maybe Maryland and a half, to give you an idea in U.S. state terms what the area is.
I did not realize it was that large.
But yeah, if you look at it on a map in Alaska, it looks tiny, but Alaska is huge.
It's, right.
Takes a little bit to put it in perspective. So it's big enough that there's a lot of variety and different things you can see and do there, but also small enough that you can get to all of the various locations you would want to go with reasonable driving times, which in exploring an area of Alaska, you really have to just pick one spot to focus on for most trips because it is just so massive. And many of the places in Alaska are very difficult, expensive, or time consuming to get to and from.
Well, and you mentioned driving time, and we're just south of Anchorage, so I'm assuming we're flying into Anchorage, and then you're recommending a driving trip to see the rest of the peninsula.
Yes, Anchorage is where you'd fly into. You can get to a few locations using public transportation. Seward particularly is accessible by the bus and the train, but if you were to go anywhere other than Seward and maybe Homer, I would recommend a rental car or possibly an RV if anyone is open to driving a giant bus around some slightly dodgy roads. Many people do it. I'm not sure I quite like driving one of those things myself, but it's very doable in cars. It's on the road system, which if you're familiar with Alaska and the Inside Passage, many destinations in Alaska are actually not. You can't drive there.
Right. And why should someone go to the Kenai Peninsula?
There's a lot to see, and it's very easy to do sort of a self-directed trip in the Kenai because there's roads and because you can travel by car. And many people's conception of a trip to Alaska is you're going to go to the Inside Passage and or you're going to go to Denali, or you go and do a cruise and then you fly up to Denali, which are both excellent destinations. But if you're trying to do an independent trip where you're setting the itinerary, you're just not just on a boat or on a bus that somebody else is driving, there can be real logistical hurdles to trying to plan a trip independently in either one of those places. Whereas with the Kenai Peninsula, it's a lot more amenable to, I want to say, more independent-minded travelers.
Okay.
Plus, you'll be getting to see many of the same things that are up in Denali that are down in the Inside Passage. We have the bears, we have the glaciers, we have the rainforest, the brilliant hikes. It's all just a little bit easier to get to.
You don't have the Great Big Mountain.
We don't have Denali. However, many people that go to Denali don't even see it from the park. Yes.
True.
You may have better chances of seeing it from Anchorage, actually, than you do going up to the national park itself.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. It's visible from Anchorage. You'll need somebody to point it out because it does not appear to be the tallest mountain that you see from town because it's much further away than some of the shorter, closer ones. But you can see it from Anchorage many days of the year.
Hmm. I did not know that. Excellent. And what kind of itinerary would you recommend for us?
So I would recommend going to one or both of the sort of larger towns in the Kenai, either Seward or Homer, and then picking two to three of the other towns or places that I'll mention. There's a lot to do in the Kenai, and I would recommend or steer people towards putting together a trip based on what their particular interests are. For example, if you want to do a trip that's based around fishing, you're going to want to go to different places as opposed to doing a trip based around hiking or wildlife viewing. There'll be some changes in the itinerary you want to make.
Okay, excellent. And you started us with Seward or Homer, Seward being one of the few cities in the U.S. named after a former Secretary of State, and Homer one of the few named after a Simpson character.
Exactly.
Or possibly not with that second one. I could be making that up, but...
You could be making that up. I'm not actually sure who Homer was named after.
Well, I'll figure that out while you're describing why we would choose one versus the other.
Both Seward and Homer are larger tourism destinations in the Kenai. They're both on the water. Seward, I would say I'm a little bit biased. I do live there. But I would say that Seward arguably has better access to the places that you want to visit, better scenery and marine wildlife very close to town. Homer arguably has the better weather.
Ah, okay. And better meaning less rain, less overcast?
Better meaning less rain and slightly better marine water conditions. Homer is facing the Cook Inlet is where it ends up, Kachemak Bay. And the water there can be a little bit more protected than outside of Seward. Seward is in Resurrection Bay, but once you leave the bay, you're right out in the Gulf of Alaska, which means two things. It means more access to marine wildlife like humpbacks and orcas, also potentially more swell and sea state getting out there to see those animals.
And you say they're tourist areas, so if I wanted to go down even just on my own and drive in, there are local operators that could hook me up with various activities like, it sounds like, whale watching, fishing trips, kayaking, and those sort of things as well?
Absolutely. For Seward, the three main things that I would recommend for a visit to Seward would be, first of all, getting out on the water, doing some sort of marine or wildlife cruise. There's a number of operators that do these, mostly sort of the standard day boats, big, maybe 100 to 150 passenger tour boat that goes out into Resurrection Bay. And you can do a tour that just stays in the bay. Those are about 3 to 4 hours. You'll be seeing some scenery, some wildlife, probably puffins, sea lions, occasionally whales. You'll get a distant look at a glacier. But I would really recommend doing one of the longer tours, 7 to 8 hours in a boat that leaves Resurrection Bay and goes out into Kenai Fjords National Park.
Okay.
And the benefit of doing the longer tour is that you'll get away from the sort of small fleet of fishing vessels that is zipping around the bay all the time in the summer, get out into more of a wilderness area. And the things that you'll see when you leave the park boundary is higher chances of whales, more time with them if you do spot whales, and also getting up to the tidewater glaciers over in Iyalik and Northwestern Bays. Iyalik Glacier in particular is a massive, massive calving glacier. It's about a mile from one end to the other. Calves pretty regularly. And for my money, seeing a tidewater glacier in Alaska is one of the things that you really must do if you come up to the state. They're amazing. So many people have heard about glaciers just in the context of news reports and climate change.
Sure.
But I think that most people don't really get an understanding of what a glacier is and how active they can be until you get out and see one in person and just hear it at work and see the ice calving off. And these tours from Seward is really a great way to get out there in the bay and see exactly that.
Now, the glacier obviously going to be there any time of year that we go. For a boat tour like this, and seeing whales, I'm guessing that that's going to be better some times of year than others.
I guess we can talk a little bit about seasons in Alaska and when to go.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, my yard in Seward has about 5 feet of snow.
And we are recording this, just so people know, in the second week of March 2017. So some of us had a nice, lovely, warm spring day today, not so much in Alaska yet.
The tourism season in Alaska is May through the end of September. May and June tend to be the driest months, especially on the coast. May, you'll still have a lot of snow in some of the higher elevations. Anywhere over maybe 800 feet, there's a chance of some of the snow from the winter not really melting off yet.
Mm-hmm.
This is also the most daylight. The solstice is in June, so that's when in the Kenai, you'll have about 18, 20 hours of daylight, 4 to 6 hours where it might get dim, but it never really gets dark. Okay. Some people really enjoy this. Other people spend that whole time they're up there complaining that they can't sleep. Some people's bodies just adjust better or worse to that.
Now, I'm guessing any hotel I stay in is going to have great big thick blackout curtains as a matter of course.
Yeah. There's definitely blinds. And again, some people adjust better than others.
Sure, yeah.
Part of it is just it's hard to tell yourself to take a break from being a tourist when it's 9 o'clock and it's still, you can still walk around and see things. May and June are also hands down the worst months for insects. So you've got daylight, you've got dry weather, you are going to be wearing a lot of sunscreen and bug spray. The bugs can get pretty bad, but in the coast, they're not generally as bad as they would be in the interior.
Mm-hmm.
July, you can start getting some rain. The hours of daylight start to even out a little bit. August and September is when things kind of change. On the coast, you can get a lot of rain. May is one of Alaska's driest months. August and September are some of the wettest.
Hmm.
So the rain shows up, the mosquitoes all drown, and the salmon and the bears begin to be a little bit more present. Most salmon runs, if you're looking to fish for salmon or see the spawning or seeing bears going after that fish, August and September, maybe a little bit into the beginning of October for some sites, are the times to come to see that. But you will be doing all of your salmon fishing and bear viewing and everything else in your rain gear. It's going to pour.
Okay. So there's trade-offs is really what I'm hearing. Do you have a favorite month?
I think May is one of the undiscovered secrets in Alaska tourism. I would definitely encourage visitors, especially first-time visitors to the state, come up in May. It's a beautiful month. There's a lot of daylight. There's a lot of sun. It's just a very easy time to experience and fall in love with Alaska. It is a little bit harder to fall in love with Alaska if you come in September and it rains the whole time you're there.
Okay. And then you, going back to Seward in terms of whale watching, that is a very seasonal thing, but is it in Seward or are you looking during the summer months at local populations of orca and things like that?
So the whale watching season in Alaska is that the whales are there longer than the tourists are. We have gray whales that are showing up in Seward now. We'll have humpbacks and orcas through the end of August, the beginning of September. So whatever month you go out to see whales, they're going to be there.
Okay.
Humpbacks out of Seward are pretty much a guarantee. Orcas can be hit or miss. There's just fewer of them. And the resident orca pods in the Seward area have a bigger range. So the day you're out visiting them in Seward, they might be over in Homer and vice versa. They just move around a lot.
That's a big range. Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. Anything else we want to talk about in Seward? Let's focus in on that for a second.
Absolutely. Seward is home to a really lovely aquarium. And I do want to put a little caveat here. I actually worked with them. I was an intern for that aquarium. The first time I ever came up to Alaska was to work for them. It's a small facility, but the great thing about the aquarium there is that it focuses entirely on local fish and invertebrates and mammals and birds. So you can walk in there. They have an open air exhibit with puffins. It's probably the closest anyone can come to a puffin. They're adorable birds. It's a great place to take photos of them. They have a touch tank there where you can check out anemones and sea urchins, see some of the animals that have come right out of the bay outside. And they also have larger animals. They have seals there as well as sea lions. And in addition to the animals that are housed there permanently, they also run a marine mammal rehabilitation program where they take in seals that have been orphaned, try and get them healthy, fatten them up, and then release them back out into the wild. And in addition to visiting the aquarium and just seeing the aquarium itself, the Sea Life Center also runs what they call encounter tours, which are basically going back into the exhibits with one of the staff there, one of the animal keepers, and feeding and hanging out with some of the animals in the collection. They run this for octopus, for the aviary, which includes the puffins, and then for their harbor seals. And the tours are about $70 a person, but for being able to get up close with a wild animal in that sort of setting, they're, I think, an amazing thing to do. Most of the time, you'll get to be feeding the animal that you're interacting with and see some of the training, see some of the ways that these keepers help make a life in captivity really entertaining for the animals that they're taking care of.
Excellent. Other things to do in Seward?
Hiking is very accessible from town. There's two main hiking areas right around Seward I want to talk about. The first is up by Exit Glacier. It's about 8 miles north of town. There is a shuttle bus that runs out there for people that don't have access to a car. And the main feature out there is Exit Glacier itself. It's a tongue of the Harding Ice Field that comes down. It's not a tidewater glacier, so it terminates on land. You can walk up reasonably close to the ice, get a good look at what that glacier is doing. And also for this particular glacier, how quickly it's been receding and what sorts of plants and life is sort of coming in to colonize the area as the glacier has been drawing further and further back. And there's two hikes in the area that will sort of give you a view of the glacier. The first is a very easy, about a mile and a half gravel loop going up the Outwash Plain. There's interpretive signs, there's boardwalks and areas, bridges, very easy hike. Anybody could very easily do this. That goes right up towards the glacier. You can kind of feel the cold air coming off the ice, see the front of it. The more strenuous trail would be the Harding Ice Field Trail, which leaves right behind the visitor center there and basically goes straight up the side of the hill to a point where you can look over not only all of Exit Glacier, but you can actually see the Harding Ice Field itself. The Harding Ice Field is this big mass of ice that is the source for just about all of the glaciers in the entire Kenai Peninsula. It's massive. It's well over 100 miles in length and about 30 miles wide. And you can see across this from a viewpoint at the end of this trail. You will tax your body getting up there. It is about 3.5 miles one way, and it is quite steep. It's a pretty well-maintained trail, but it is kind of like being on a stair stepper for 2 hours with the benefit of a view. It's pretty steep.
Okay.
But I don't want to put people off trying the trail, because even if you don't go all the way to the viewpoint where you can see the ice field, once you get above treeline, which in Seward happens at around 600 or 800 feet of elevation, mm-hmm. you get really phenomenal views of Exit Glacier and then looking back down the Outwash Plain towards Seward. So early spring, that's a good place to look for wildflowers throughout the summer. There will be snow up there if you go early up in the year, and snow can stay on the trail until the end of July or early August some years. It's kind of interesting to see. Yeah, it can be 70 degrees, you're hiking in t-shirts, and you're hiking through snow.
Excellent. Any other things to do in Seward?
There's one other trail I can talk about, mm-hmm. and this would be at the southern end of town. And there's two ways to access this trail network. This is an area called Caneshead State Park. Side note, state parks are amazing. They don't get enough press in national sort of
sure.
tourism guides, mm-hmm. but they can be real phenomenal gems, and this is one of them. There's two ways to access the trails here. The first is a short hike from a place called Lowell Point. It's about 2 miles down a dirt road from Seward. There's parking there. Mm-hmm. It's about, I'd say, a 2 mile trail out to a place called Tonsina Creek, which is a salmon stream late in the summer. So it's a place where you can go and see fish swimming up the river, look for bears that might be hanging out, getting a meal there. And a really lovely beach as well, and also some earthquake trees, which are preserved trees, remnants from the 1964 earthquake that actually dropped the level of the land there so much that trees were sucking up salt water in their root systems and basically pickled themselves before they died. It's sort of a remnant forest of all of these dead preserved trunks.
Interesting. I haven't heard of that phenomena, and I live in earthquake country, but I guess we don't have that kind of vertical shift where I live. It's more of a horizontal.
Interesting.
And then in terms of Seward, before we leave it, other recommendations in terms of places to eat or places to stay?
Definitely recommendations for places to eat.
I figured you might have one or two.
There are two very nice seafood restaurants right in the Seward Boat Harbor, Ray's and Chinook's. They both overlook the boat harbor, fantastic seafood, and also a fantastic view. So you can be sitting there eating your king crab, and you look out the window, and there's sea otter sitting there eating his crab. It's just a fantastic spot.
Okay. Sounded like a place we ought to get a Chinook salmon instead of a crab. But yeah,
yeah, all the seafood there is very good. And it's including the things that the locals might actually throw back. If you're fishing out here, rockfish is kind of the fish that the fishermen that live around here, they'll throw it back. It's not really something they want. It's actually delicious. Don't be turned away by the fish that doesn't necessarily have the star power of, say, the salmon or the halibut. It's all really good.
Excellent. Well, we've got to keep moving. So shall we go do what there is to do in Homer and then talk about some of the other destinations you wanted to mention?
Absolutely. To start with, Homer is on the opposite side of the Kenai Peninsula from Seward. Mm-hmm. If you're driving directly from Anchorage, it's probably about four and a half hours getting down there. And it is famous for being the so-called end of the road for the U.S. highway system. And I think a lot of people end up in Homer precisely because there is nowhere further you can go. It is literally the end of the line.
And it is not, as I've learned, named after a Simpsons character. You might be surprised, but it is named after someone who was in the gold mining business in the 1800s.
All right. A little bit of local history. Thank you. So things to do in Homer. Homer has a reputation as sort of a burgeoning arts community in the Kenai Peninsula. So there's a lot of galleries. There's a number of visitor centers and small museums. The Pratt Museum is particularly good if anybody is interested in looking into some of that gold mining history, some of the native Alaskan history of the area as well. That's a lovely place to stop by. And it also has the Homer Spit, which is basically a 7-mile-long sandbar that sticks out into the middle of the Cook Inlet. It's really fascinating. People look at this thing and think that has got to be man-made. There is no way that nature would just put something this long and this straight and this skinny in the middle of this body of water for no particular reason. But it is actually a natural construction, something about how the currents deposit sand in that area. And the Homer Spit is where a lot of the tour operators, the small boat harbor, anything marine related would be based out of there.
Well, and it looks like it is technically the end of the end of the road.
End of the end of the road. Other things to do in Homer. Homer has, just across the Cook Inlet, is Kachemak Bay State Park, which is a state park you cannot drive to. There's no roads going to it, so you would be getting over there by a small boat, generally locally known as water taxis. There are a couple of communities on that side of the inlet, Halibut Cove and Seldovia. They're basically roadless towns. Everything's boardwalked, gravel path. There are also a little bit of artist communities, a lot of bed and breakfasts, some very well-respected local restaurants over in both of those areas, and also a network of trails. So a day that you could put together leaving from Homer, going over to that side of the bay, would be taking a water taxi over, hiking out to another glacier out off Watch Plain. There are glaciers outside of Homer. You just can't get to them by boat. You have to hike in a little bit to see them, but they are hidden away back there. You can also kayak on that side of the bay. There's a number of remote lodgings over there that will put people up. And these range anywhere from hostel style places where the guy that drives you over in the boat is also going to be fixing your dinner and, you know, cleaning up the cabins, to real destination lodges like the Tutka Bay Wilderness Lodge, where the activities that they run include a cooking class with a Cordon Bleu trained chef, that sort of thing.
Hmm. Okay. And that one, I'm guessing we have to plan in advance to get in during the busy season. Is that true with all the places over there? Or?
With some places, yes. Like with Tutka Bay, I would guess you'd probably need to plan that pretty well in advance. But with a lot of the other accommodations, no. I would say a week ahead of time, probably. I wouldn't necessarily want to show up in Homer and not have a place to stay. Mm-hmm. The more remote an area you're looking at, the more you're going to want to plan things ahead of time to make sure that you've got a spot where you want to sleep that night.
Okay. Now, I'm guessing that occasionally there will be weather issues that will keep me from taking one of the water taxis across to wherever I am planning on staying on the other side of the area.
That can occasionally be an issue. However, with Homer being in the Cook Inlet in the Kachemak Bay, it's actually a little bit more protected than you would think.
Okay.
Generally speaking, the water taxis are able to safely run in most conditions, and many of them do have contingency plans if, you know, for whatever reason, the weather means that it's not safe to get over or get back. If you are staying at sort of a destination place and you know that you're going to be, there might be a tight time frame either getting or leaving, I would recommend maybe a night in Homer at the beginning or end of a trip like that, just in case there's weather issues. But honestly, the boat traffic back and forth can actually be a little bit more reliable than fly-in lodges, which can also be affected by weather.
Sure.
And are also something I want to talk about in relation to Homer. If you want to do any sort of specific bear viewing while you're touring around the Kenai, Homer is your departure city for that. And that's because one of the prime bear viewing locations in Alaska would be across from Homer on the other side of the Cook Inlet in places like the Katmai Coast or Lake Clark.
Okay.
You may not have heard of the Katmai Coast, but I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of Brooks Lodge. And that would be where that location is. That's the brown bears eating salmon right from the waterfall. The salmon basically jumping right into the bears' mouths at times.
Okay.
So these are definitely on the pricier end. Even looking at flying out to Katmai for a day, not even spending the night, that's going to run you about $600 to $700 on the cheap end. Hmm. That would be about 2 hours flying over on a small plane, getting to the location, spending 3 to 6 hours with the bears. This is sort of intense photography would be the best way to describe these experiences. This is for folks that really want to spend a lot of time sitting in a blind, watching these animals, maybe in the rain while they're doing it. But the photographic opportunities are really key. And a lot of these specific bear viewing tours out of Homer are kind of put together with the serious photographer in mind.
Okay. Interesting. And of course, it's nice to go when the salmon are running because it's easier to see the bears and they're well fed.
Yeah. The peak season for many of these places is during the salmon run.
Later in the summer, into the
fall. Yeah, later in the summer, August, September. Talk with the outfit that you want to go with if this is something that you want to do, because this is one of those things where if you're serious about seeing bears, you need to plan your entire trip around that trip out to see the bears. They're very popular. They book up in advance. Hmm. And there's certain windows that are much better than others. For many of these bear viewing locations, there's a peak of activity in late May, early June, where the bears are out eating grasses because the fish aren't in yet. They actually graze on sedge, and these meadows can be pretty easy to see them in. There's sort of a lull in July. The bears are no longer in the meadows as much, but the salmon aren't really in yet. And then things pick back up again as soon as the fish come in.
And I am quickly Googling sedge. What is... You've caught me there. You more of a biologist than I am there.
Well, it's just a kind of grass.
Okay. Any grass growing on wet ground? Okay, got it. Okay. I got you now. Excellent. Anything else we want to do in Homer before we talk about some other places? You mentioned you're starting to move into off of Homer into the Katmai National Park, for instance, and preserve. Other places we want to get to in the area?
That's probably a good summing up of the highlights in Homer.
and then other highlights on the Kenai.
So for other destinations in the Kenai, there's about three places that I would recommend people consider, again, based on what their particular interests are. And that would be Cooper Landing, if you're interested in freshwater fishing or a float trip, seeing the scenery from a big inflatable raft. That would be the town of Hope, if you're looking for a really charming mining community. Hope also has some good hiking and is also home to sort of the other end of our river trip. Hope has the 6 Mile Creek, which is neither a creek, also not 6 miles long. I'm not sure how it got that name, but a relic of the gold mining past. And it is one of the most ferocious rivers to be commercially guided anywhere in the world.
Oh, really?
This is the rafting trip for adrenaline junkies. You want to come to Hope and you want to run this river.
What class rapids are we talking about here?
Five, class five plus.
Gosh. Okay, all right.
If you do this trip, they put you in dry suits and they have everybody do a swim test before they will even let you get in the boat. It's pretty serious.
Yeah, well, class five is some danger involved, and anything above that is, yeah, you're on your own. So, interesting. And then you said it's a mining town, an old mining town, or are they still mining there?
There's not any large-scale active mines in Hope that I'm aware of.
Okay.
There is some recreational mining going on. But around the turn of the century, Hope was actually a larger town than Seward. It was home to about 3,000 people. Today, about 150 on a good day. So a lot of the old mining structures are still around. There's a really nice local museum. There's a lovely cafe there, the Seaview Cafe. And it's just a really charming town and one of those places that you can walk around and think that you could easily be 80, 100 years in the past. All of that stuff is still there. It's just got a lot more moss growing on it these days.
Okay.
Another reason to go to Hope is there is a trail out to a place called Gull Rock. It's about 5 miles all the way out to the rock, but that trail is going right along the side of the Cook Inlet, so there's views over the bay, and it is one of the places in Alaska where I've actually seen beluga whales from land
down
the trail. I heard them breathing before I even saw them and was running off into the woods to try and figure out where this noise was coming from. And there were a pod of beluga whales right down there at the base of the trail.
We've talked about going to see the beluga whales. If people are interested in that, check out the episode we did on Churchill, Manitoba, which has a large population of beluga whales, and hear about swimming with them, which is quite the story. So,
oh, that sounds fantastic.
Now, when we were in Seward, you mentioned a couple great hikes. Are there other favorite hikes of yours further afield in the peninsula?
There's quite a few. And this is where having a rental car can be really valuable, because a lot of these hikes, there's no public transportation to the trailhead. But the Kenai has a lot of lakes in the area. Mm-hmm. And many of the hike, if you want to do hiking in Kenai, is kind of like lake bagging. There's trails going up to lakes all over the place. Lost Lake is a very nice one. The trailhead starts about 8 miles out of Seward. You can also access the other end of the trail from a place called Primrose, about 15 miles north of Seward. And most of that hike is above tree lines, so it's a lovely place for wildflowers later on in the year.
And you say later on in the year, wildflowers are a fall thing?
Well, later on in the season, I
guess.
Later
on in the season. Okay, I was going to say, I was thinking of wildflowers as a spring thing, so you were throwing me there for a second. Excellent. Any other hikes you want to mention while we're at it?
Well, moving on to another destination that I might recommend people consider, there's some nice hikes around the town of Girdwood. Now, Girdwood is a little bit more of a resort town than any of the other places I've mentioned. It's home to Alaska's only resort-style ski resort, which is Alyeska. And the resort is also open in the summer for summer tourism and everything that goes along with that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the benefits to visiting Girdwood is that the ski gondola system still runs in the summer. So it's a very quick and easy way to get up above tree line. I think the gondola goes up to about 2,000 feet, so you're well up in the tundra, well in the alpine area, and you have a great view back over the Turnagain Arm. So it's scenery and an entirely different plant community than what you'd see with the trails that start from the road system or from around sea level. And the access to it is really easy. You just pay to get on the gondola. It'll take you straight up. There's also a restaurant up at the top there. There's some signposted hiking trails. It's open enough that you can pretty much just wander around up there pretty easily. And there's a small museum.
Okay.
You can also hike directly from the town of Girdwood from the resort itself. The trail is called the North Face Trail. It's very well maintained. Definitely a workout. You're going up about 1,500 feet over the course of a couple of miles. But the good thing is, if you hike up the North Face Trail to the platform where the gondola unloads people, you can actually ride the gondola back down for free. You only pay to go up.
Okay. I've been in other places like that. In Banff, for instance, I think has a similar system. I always liked that to reward those people who are a little more adventurous.
Another good trail in the Girdwood area is the Winter Creek Trail. This is very, very popular. It starts right behind the Alyeska Hotel, and it's about a 2-mile walk, reasonably level, pretty well maintained, over to a hand tram that goes over the Winter Creek Gorge. Now, one thing you need to understand about Alaska is the lawyers have not gotten here yet.
The winters are too cold. Is that the problem?
Maybe so. It's fine with me. Keep them away. The hand tram looks like something that was left over from a mine. I'm not sure if that's where it came from, but it's basically this little bucket attached to some airplane cable and this little hand-powered crank. And there's a little cage attached to it that looks like it came out of an elevator back when they had elevator guys, you know, right. Opening and closing the doors and pressing the buttons for you. Just this little wire cage. And you can pull yourself across the gorge in this little wire cage to the other side. The trail continues from there.
Wait.
Okay.
When you say pull yourself across the gorge, how high up am I in this little contraption?
It's like 60 or 80 feet.
Okay.
I don't like looking down. it's high enough for that.
Not for people who have a fear of heights and not for lawyers. We won't allow them to come to this. Okay. All right.
Yeah. So most people hike down to the hand tram. They go across, they take their pictures, and then take the hand tram back to the original side and then hike back up. And the good way to do that is if you get to the hand tram and decide, this is not for me, you just take pictures of other people going over in the hand tram and you hike back up.
Okay. I like that idea. Okay. Interesting. Most of the things that we have described really are outdoors, wildlife, or adventure travel related. I'm guessing if that's not what you're looking for, you're in the wrong place if you've come to Kenai or maybe even Alaska.
In a sense, that's probably true. You can see a lot of Alaska without leaving the confines of a cruise ship or a bus.
Sure.
There's also ways to basically pay tour operators to make your Alaskan experience as gourmet and as easy and as high thread count sheet as possible. But for most people, that's not necessarily the best way to see Alaska.
Sure.
If people have any sort of mobility issue or want to see the wildlife and the scenery without necessarily hiking or, you know, getting on water taxis, those would be people that maybe steer towards the Inside Passage, towards a trip like the one that you took with Uncruise, I believe it was last year, 2 years ago.
2 years ago, I think. Except that one involved a lot of hiking, bushwhacking, and sea kayaking. So I think possibly you'd go on the bigger boat with the pool instead of the Uncruise, which, you know, frankly, was a better match for what I was looking for.
There's definitely ways to see Alaska if you're not into hiking or adventure travel, but so much of Alaska is geared around wilderness and hiking and getting out there into the wild. Be prepared for those sorts of experiences if you come up here, because that's really what a trip to Alaska is all about.
For people who have just seen Alaska on the National Geographic Channel, what is going to surprise them about the Kenai Peninsula?
Oh, quite a lot. The program that features Jewel Kilcher's family. I don't know, Alaska's Last Frontier or something. You might need to Google this.
Yeah.
It's actually shot outside of Homer. You know, the folks live on a road. So a lot of how Alaska is portrayed in reality TV, there's a lot that's exaggerated, but there's actually a lot that really isn't. You can wake up in the morning and there's a moose, you know, grazing outside next to your rental car. And you're wondering, well, how am I going to go anywhere? Is this part of a Lund, Alaska visit is about? It's a place where nature is really setting the itinerary a lot of the time.
More like, we haven't talked about meese. Where am I more likely to see a moose?
Likeliest place to see a moose is actually driving over to Homer. There's mountains on the Kenai side of the peninsula. You get into an area called the Kenai Flats on the other side of Cooper Landing. So there's a pretty long stretch of wildlife refuge, and it's possible to see moose right there from the highway, just grazing, doing their thing.
Excellent. Anything else we want to cover in terms of destinations before we get into more of the wrap-up questions?
I guess I really only just touched on Cooper Landing, which is a town sort of midway between Seward and Homer. And if you're looking to do any sort of freshwater fishing in the Kenai, Cooper Landing is the place to go. There's the Kenai River, the Russian River. These are world-famous sport fishing destinations, and there are a ton of companies with excellent guides to take you out in those boats, check out the area, and get some fish. If you're not interested in fishing, there's also float trips that leave from there, which are a little bit more scenery-oriented, and those float trips are also great places to see wildlife. If you go in the latter half of the season, July, August, September, you'll probably be seeing fish in the river with you. You'll definitely be seeing bald eagles everywhere going after those fish. And there's also possibility of seeing bears in the river as well.
I know bald eagles at one point were in danger of extinction. Based on my experience in southeastern Alaska, that is no longer the case.
It was actually never the case in Alaska. They were endangered in the lower 48, but the populations in Alaska have always been pretty robust.
You didn't have the DDT runoff that we did. Sure, that makes sense. Here's a tough one. You're standing in the prettiest spot in the Kenai Peninsula. Where are you standing? What are you looking at?
I am standing on a hillside overlooking the Patterson Glacier out in the middle of the Kenai Fjords National Park. I'm looking down at the glacier and the lake it calves into, and I am eating the wild blueberries that grow on the top of that hill.
Excellent. Excellent. The blueberries being a nice touch there, too. I like that idea. Besides yourself, one local you really wish everybody could meet.
Oh, boy.
And Meredith would get my vote for that, by the way. So that's why I wanted her to name somebody else. So
I would probably say Dan Seavey.
Okay.
Some people may know him as the grandfather of the reigning Iditarod champion, Dallas Seavey. The Iditarod is actually going on as we speak.
Oh, this late in the season. I didn't realize that. Huh.
Yeah, they run it in March.
Hmm.
But Dan Seavey moved to Seward in the 50s, right before the earthquake. He was a school teacher. He mushed dogs. He is the patriarch of this very famous mushing family in Alaska. And he's also a really wonderful historian. And if you do not have the pleasure of actually meeting him in person, he has written a book about his experience called The First Great Race. The Iditarod is sometimes known as the last great race. Well, Dan Seavey was one of the people that ran the Iditarod the first year that the race was run, and that those experiences are covered in that book. I would highly recommend it to anyone interested in Alaska history or the Iditarod and dog mushing. Fabulous book.
Interesting. And we talked more about the Iditarod in an episode we did, I think it was last year, about some remote destinations in Alaska, including Nome. So listen to that episode if you want more about Iditarod history. What should people remember to take with them besides their bug spray?
Bug spray is a good one. Rain jackets would be the other thing that really needs to be on everybody's packing list.
No matter what time of year I'm going.
No matter what time of year.
Okay.
May can be dry, but it can rain any time of the year. And if you're out on boats or fishing or going out on water taxis, you're going to want something for the spray. Okay. It's just a wet part of the country, I guess.
Last three questions. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in the Kenai Peninsula.
So later on in the summer, when we get a lot of rain, the drainage ditches on the highway start to overflow and you can have salmon running upstream to spawn in the drainage ditches next to the highway. I don't know where else in the world you would have that.
Finish this thought. You can really tell you're in the Kenai Peninsula when what?
When you're sitting on your porch after dinner, broad daylight, and you look at your watch and realize it's 10:30 at night.
And if you had to summarize the Kenai Peninsula in just three words, what three words would you use?
Lush,
mm-hmm.
epic, mm. and alive.
Excellent. Our guest again has been Marith Griffith. And Marith, you don't have a website, so I'm guessing the usual story I ask about where you've written about the Kenai is not applicable.
Not really. I am actually published in a tiny book of local Seward history that's coming out in the next couple of months. I don't know if you want to plug that.
Sure.
So the book is Seward Unleashed, Volume 2. And I have an essay of mine in there that describes my first summer working in Seward as a tour guide and a few of the things I learned during that process.
What kind of things did you learn being a tour guide in Seward?
I learned that a lot of being a successful tour guide isn't necessarily the things you hope to see on any given tour, but mm-hmm. it's being appreciative of whatever happens to show up.
Sure.
Because sometimes what shows up is far and beyond what you'd actually expected to find.
Well, and wildlife has a tendency to be wild and not as predictable as some tourists might like.
No, they're terrible to schedule. They never show up on time.
But sometimes you end up with that unexpected experience as the cruise we were on in Baja, where we were amazed by a pod of 300 dolphins. And then an hour later, we found ourselves in a pod of 2,000 to 3,000 dolphins. And you just never could have predicted that.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Well, Marith, thank you so much for coming on the Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your love for Alaska and for the Kenai Peninsula.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely to be invited on your show.
In news of the community, I heard this week from Ernest, who said, just heard your podcast on Zambia. Loved it. You have one opportunity to take on African safari. Which country or countries would you go to and when? Tough to say. I think there are arguments for a number of countries. Tanzania is the only sub-Saharan country that I have been to, and we're talking safari, we're talking sub-Saharan. And so it's got a closeness in my heart, and certainly Ngorongoro Crater and the Serengeti, which is there on the border between Tanzania and Kenya, are world-class destinations. But it might be that there's particular animals you want to see. If you want to see lemurs, then you want to go to Madagascar. If you want to see mountain gorillas, Uganda or Rwanda. We've done shows on all of those different places. Or if you want to do that and wine tasting, maybe it's South Africa. So it really depends a little bit on what you're looking for. I heard from Clemente, who left an iTunes review, and thanks so much for that. That helps people find the show. It says, this is my first iTunes review, and this podcast is well deserving of the honor. Brilliant travel podcast for binge listeners. I listened to one of the UNESCO World Heritage Site episodes and discovered I had visited more than one UNESCO site without even knowing it. So I did some research and found out that I have been to at least 40. That blew my mind, and all thanks to the Amateur Traveler. Also, episode number 290 on the Azores was rather special because I'm from the Azores, and Janine Barone's best day in the Azores happens to be the same as mine. The trek down from the Serra to Fajada Caldera de Santo Cristo on the island of São Jorge is one of the most beautiful places on the planet. Caldaria, as the locals call it, happens to be my father's village. I was baptized in Caldaria, and that hike down the mountain, through the valley, between the pastures, past old abandoned houses that used to belong to my ancestors, and down to the Faja by the ocean is breathtaking. I was walking it with my brother, and he turned to me and said, you know what this is, don't you? This is the Shire. And I agreed. The Shire exists on Earth, and it's on the island of São Jorge in the Azores. Love the podcast. And please excuse my pronunciation of all the place names there. But thanks so much, Clemente, for the review. With that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com or a review in iTunes. Links on how to do that, as well as links of everything we talked about in this show, are in the lyrics of this episode, as well as in the show notes on the website. And thanks so much for listening.